This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll check in with Andy Downs, who's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue Fort Wayne, soon to be Purdue University Fort Wayne, to get his assessment of how the primary election went across Indiana, and particularly here in the northern half of the state, ranging from his view on the U.S. Senate GOP race to the statewide ticket. We'll also talk with Selena Weatherwax with the Mack Foundation about how the Valparaiso-based organization has a new collaboration with OSHA. And we'll talk with two psychologists and some other folks involved from the Safe Coalition for Human Rights about the concern about human trafficking here in Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, the primary election was last Tuesday, and maybe had time for the dust to settle and for the records to be kept up. And let's find out, at least get the assessment of one political analyst in particular. Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, based in Fort Wayne. Have they changed the name of the campus yet, Andy?
That's not until July 1st.
July 1st.
You were correct when you called us Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne, although when you call me in July, you'll have to say Purdue University, Fort Wayne.
That's right. We have to remember about the change coming up here. That's another story altogether. But
it is.
What we want to do is spend some time here in the next few minutes to talk about this primary election that was held last Tuesday and how things seem to go. Let's take a very look on the global view here, how the entire primary election cycle went. Then we'll kind of break it down by Indiana races or Indiana governmental races, maybe we should say, as well as the races for Congress, the seats that were open. And then we can finish up here by taking a look at the U.S. Senate race here. So let's look first at how the overall general primary election cycle went in your view.
Well, for a lot of people, this was a fairly low turnout, and I would agree with them. We were expecting, given the excitement in the Senate race, as well as in the 2nd, 4th, 6th, and 9th with their hotly contested primaries, that we would see pretty good turnout, not to mention the fact that at the local level, including in some cases township board races, there were a lot of people lined up to run for office and running good campaigns. We sort of expected a pretty good turnout, but you know, statewide, it was okay. It was not great by any stretch of the imagination. Not nearly what we would expect.
I know up here in Northwest Indiana, in particular, some of the officials in Lake and Porter counties were disappointed by the turnout. Some had hoped maybe they weren't expecting 40-50%, but they were expecting a little more than about 10 or 15%, which is the way some of the counties turned out. They just didn't have the turnout they hoped for, and they thought, especially in some of the races in particular here in Lake County, with the Democratic Party races, for so many candidates on the ballot for a county sheriff, for example, or you're talking about township races, in particular, Calumet Township Board of Directors have only four spaces, but they had seemed like a bunch of candidates that wanted to take one of those four seats. So
yeah, it wasn't a seems like. That was a bunch of candidates who wanted those seats.
Yeah.
Those were highly coveted seats. And now we always think that contested elections bring out voters, and that's true, but there are a couple of other factors to consider. First, in the end, campaigns have no interest in a high turnout. They have an interest in turnout of their voters. So they're not going to try and turn out voters in general, but only their voters. And if they can target people who support them, and that's going to be enough of a turnout to get them a victory, they're not going to go looking for more people. So that's one factor. The other factor is that when races get ugly, it does have a tendency to sort of drive turnout back down. And for a lot of folks, the Senate race on the Republican side, a lot of people refer to it as one of the ugliest, if not the ugliest, in the United States so far this year.
Yeah.
So that probably contributed to the lower turnout as well.
And we'll get into more detail about that, but we know in particular, too, that the U.S. Senate Republican candidate race was also certainly one of the not only the most contested as far as how the campaign went, but it was also one of the most competitive battleground races, too, it seemed like, in the country. But we'll get into that in just a moment. Let's take a look here at the races for the House of Representatives. And we know here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in District 1, it seemed to be a pretty safe bet that Pete Fiskoski, the incumbent congressman, was going to get his chance to go up against some Republican candidate this year. And he only had two challengers, but had no trouble trying to fight them off.
Oh, that's certainly true, and that's what people have come to expect in the first district. Viskoski does a nice job with casework and certainly has been there for a long time. Some people may not like him. In fact, we know some people don't like him. But in the end, he's one of those incumbents who is seems to take care of the people back home, votes in ways that make the people in that district happy. And so those are two things. If you do them, you're and then run serious campaigns. I should throw that one in there. And if you do that, you're more than likely going to be reelected.
Now, we know that the folks that didn't want to see Pete Fiskoski get as many points as he wanted for the chance to vie for a chance to win in November, of course, were the ones who were opposed to the South Shore Line expansion projects, in particular the South Lake project, the one that runs through Lake County. Not so much the expansion of the double tracks between Gary and Michigan City, but they just weren't happy about that and some other things, too, that involve some of the Northwest Indiana governmental organizations.
Well, it's true. When you start thinking about where money gets spent, quite often people are able to say, you know what, that's jobs. They may not like that particular project, but it means some people are going to be employed. It means people are going to get paid pretty good wages, typically, if we're talking about construction projects funded by the feds. I will be okay with that for that reason. I may prefer those dollars be spent elsewhere in a place that I think is more efficient, more effective, it brings greater equity. But in the end, as long as they're being spent here, it's better than them being spent elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And we know now that they've got the election over with, that Pete Fiskoski is once again going to face Mark Leyva, who is going to be the Republican challenger on the ballot in November. Leyva has run several times for several different offices in Northwest Indiana, but he's run against Congressman Fiskoski several times in the past, and he's going to have another chance once again. But there are a couple other potential candidates, or potential winners, maybe we should say, that are on the ballot, John Meyer and Roseanne Ivanovich, who are two attorneys living and working in Northwest Indiana within District 1, and they seem to have promise, and they seem to do pretty well as far as the vote's concerned, but just not as well enough as Mark Leyva did.
Yeah, and it was almost an exact tie between those two, and we'll see what happens 2 years from now. Obviously, Leyva has name recognition on his side. Campaigning in Northwest Indiana is an expensive proposition because when you talk about campaigning over the airwaves, you're often talking about needing to buy Chicago television, which is really expensive, but radio and other means give you better targeting. I think that if you were to ask these two to run again, or if they were to run again, I think we might see a slightly different result because they've obviously done a little bit to build up their name recognition. And I might argue that if they both weren't in, one of them would have won, whether it was, you know, either one, doesn't matter. If it had been simply one of them against Leyva, I think they might have had a chance of winning. But in the end, they probably split up the anti-Leyva vote in some respect.
Good point, too. And Nick Pappas was the other candidate that brought in about 19% of the total vote out of that, too. So it's hard to say what could have happened in that case, too. Now, looking on to District 2, which is the other district that we're looking at, of course, over here in Northwest Indiana, it's off just to our immediate east here. But we do have areas in our coverage area that want to know what happens there. That's that's going to be the case where Jackie Walorski, the incumbent, is going to go up against a good Democratic challenger, somebody who picked up about 47% of the overall vote. Tell us, once you know a little bit about Mel Hall and how you think his chances might be to go up against Jackie Walorski in November.
Well, this would be an interesting case because Mel Hall is somebody who has deep roots in the community as somebody who's invested in and given back to the community. That's not to say that the other candidates on the ballot, on both ballots, haven't done that. But this is what he's known for. He is known for his contributions in the community. In fact, I was talking with someone just yesterday who used to live up in South Bend, who now lives over my way. He said, I saw this commercial, and I was shocked to see it was Mel Hall. I didn't pay attention to the beginning, but I thought, is that the Mel Hall I know from church days, you know, 15 years ago? I said, yeah, that's him. So it will be, you know, this is clearly somebody who is given, who is a servant. And that's going to be a pretty good biography to use against Walorski. But at the same time, there's got to be more than the biography. You know, this is a district that is still kind of a Republican district, and so that's in Walorski's favor, obviously. She's a proven vote-getter at in terms of both the General Assembly and now Congress. Hall has a long way to go. He did a good job raising money in the spring, but now he's got to turn right around and raise, you know, quite a few times what he raised in the spring in order to be a viable candidate come the fall.
Are there any other congressional races that you've kept a look at from the primary election on Tuesday night that might be worth mentioning? I know Jim Baird is probably one that I'm sure a lot of people were watching because that's in Todd Rokita's district, the seat that he had, and I'm sure that a lot of people were surprised that he would make the move from state representative to run for Congress.
Yeah, that district's a little south of where you are, obviously. And initially, you know, a lot of people didn't jump into that race. It was expected when Rokita announced he was running for Senate, there would just be, you know, a ton of people who'd say, I want that seat, because it's a pretty darn safe Republican seat. So it took a while for some people to get in, and then we ended up with a pretty tight three-way race, or what looked like was going to be a pretty tight three-way race. And Jim Baird was not, if I remember right, not the top fundraiser in the area. A lot of people expected Steve Braun, that last name might sound familiar, but yeah, they expected Steve Braun to win that. Baird, though, talked about his service in the General Assembly, talked about his service in the military, and was able to basically present a very compelling biography in addition to good stance on the issues that sort of drives home a point. The biography is important, and being an outsider of sorts is a good thing, but it's okay to have served the public in some way, shape, or form, and use that as a way to catapult yourself into a victory. So being an outsider doesn't mean having never served the public before. It just means you have to describe it in the right way and have done it in the right way. That'll be interesting because Toby Beck, the Democratic nominee, also is a vet. She spent a lot of time talking about that, so that will be interesting. And then two other House races very quickly. People were watching the Republican primary over in the 6th District, so the west or east central part of the state. Greg Pence was running for that seat. People expected him to win. He did with about two-thirds of the vote. He beat off a, I think people would say, surprising challenge from a gentleman named Jonathan Lamb, who was able to self-finance, a young person was able to self-finance. That was interesting. And then the other one down in the 9th District, so south central and southeastern Indiana, that was on the Democratic side. Liz Watson and Dan Cannon were going at it, and Watson ended up running away with that. I'll say running away. That's a bit of a disservice, but people expected that to be a lot tighter. She ended up with two-thirds of the vote, so she will now take on first-termer Trey Hollingsworth in the fall.
The carpetbagger.
You got it. And I was going to say, that's the race that people remember from 2 years ago, because that was Shelley Yoder against Trey Hollingsworth back when he was initially given that carpetbagger label.
We're talking with Andy Downs with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics over in Fort Wayne about how this primary election turned out that's just ended. Now let's talk about the big race, the one that was the most contentious probably of any that anybody's ever seen, at least in recent memory, to be sure. Talking about the Republican Party's U.S. Senate race, fighting three people, fighting each other, and finally turning out to be with the winner. We note as well, too, that's here again, another outsider. Tell us your thoughts about how that's turned out with Mr. Braun and with incumbent Joe Donnelly.
Yeah, Mike Braun, the outsider, in this case, an outsider who, once again, had served in the General Assembly, had served on a school board. So you can serve. It just can't be what defines you, apparently. That's what appears to be, I'd say, at this point. If you look at the results from that race, initially, a lot of people were saying it would be either Messer or Rokita, and Braun was just sort of this other person who was, fortunately for him, able to self-finance to the tune of a whole lot of money. But Braun very early on defined himself as the outsider, as the person who was following the path of Donald Trump, as the person who, as he put it, the only person I will owe anything to is you. So he tried to make it sound like he was not beholden to anybody. And he was a business person, just wanted to go do a little quick work and then come back to the state. He did that effectively. By the time Messer and Rokita started to try and label him as something other than that, it was basically too late. The label had fit, was on him, it stuck. He was able to carry that through, and if you look on a county-by-county basis, you'll see that Messer did very well, obviously, in his congressional district. Rokita did well in his congressional district, and unfortunately for the two of them, Braun did well just about everywhere else. That's kind of bad news for Joe Donnelly, because that means that Braun was not running from a small base of support, but support that actually existed throughout the entire state. And now Donnelly has to campaign throughout the entire state, which he was more than likely going to do anyway.
In fact, I know that CNN had listed this. Well, some of the ratings outlets had called this race a toss-up anyway. And then CNN, I know, listed the seat among the 10 U.S. Senate seats it considered the most likely to flip in 2018. So you still see, at least from now, at this point in time, before we get much closer to November, of that possibility?
Well, I think so. This, you know, it's a Republican, it's a conservative state, and it's a good time to be a Republican in this conservative state. Republicans have had great electoral success here. Mike Braun probably is the best of the three Republican candidates to run against Donnelly because he can take that outsider label. He can take what people liked about Donald Trump. He doesn't have to take what they disliked about him. He doesn't have a voting record that is easy to tie to Donald Trump the way Messer or Rokita did. He doesn't look like sort of the traditional Republican in the way Luke Messer did. He doesn't look like the pugnacious fighter-type person that Todd Rokita presented himself as. So Mike Braun's probably the best opponent for against Joe Donnelly in terms of the Republicans' chances of picking up that seat. But you throw all that together, and Joe Donnelly has a lot of work ahead of him. But I do want to point out very quickly, Joe Donnelly, I think it was the next day, was running a commercial that said, "I'm just the hired help. I was hired by you. I work for you." So they're both pretty much saying they're there for us. Forget the party label. They're there working for us. Now we just have to see who stands on the issues we like better, I guess.
Well, if there was just one point that you could think of that you could mention here as we kind of wrap things up here, what might it be to look forward to come November?
It's always voter turnout. Do you have a good enough message that resonates with enough voters to win? And I think they both do. In spite of the fact that Joe Donnelly is a Democrat in the state at a time when it's better to be a Republican in general, he's a moderate, and he's done good casework throughout the state. He's backed issues that seem to be important to voters in the state. So I'm sure he knows who his supporters are, and Braun knows who his supporters are. Now it's a question of making sure they stay interested and excited enough that those supporters convince that small pool of undecided voters to go in one direction or the other.
Andy Downs is the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And as always, Andy, thank you for being with us to talk about this election just ended, and we'll have you back on, I'm sure, several times taking a look at things as they develop in the campaign during the summer.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
An organization and a facility we've talked about before. It's based in Valparaiso, a nonprofit organization called the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative Foundation. That's a big word for MAC Foundation. Is showing an opportunity to expand not only its operation here in Northwest Indiana, but provide more training services for all kinds of organizations now in Northwest Indiana, with a new affiliation with a special organization that involves training for businesses and factories and the like. And to be with us to talk about this particular collaboration, we have from the MAC Foundation, Selena Weatherwax. Selena, thanks for joining us here in Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to have me, Chris.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with the MAC Foundation, if you'll briefly tell us about that.
Yes, to your point, the MAC Foundation is a nonprofit, a 501c3 located in Valparaiso, but our target area is a five-county region, and our primary focus is to provide training opportunities for first responders throughout those five counties. Mm-hmm. So focus in Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, and Jasper counties, to be more specific.
I think the last time that we talked, it was talking about something that MAC Foundation was working on in helping train volunteer firefighters across the region.
Yes, and that continues to be our core focus. So majority of fire departments are volunteers. We have about 70% or so that are made up of entirely volunteers.
Right.
And so our focus is continue to offer them training opportunities at no cost. Okay. And we're doing that on our 4.5-acre campus in Valpo. Okay.
Now, the latest collaboration that's just come up that we're talking about today is with the Mid-America OSHA Training Education Center. It's based in Ohio. It's a very new training collaborative. Tell us about that.
The OSHA Training Education Center is an actual co-op between OSHA and Department of Labor. So they are the nonprofit training arm of those entities. And we're really excited about this partnership because now we have been added, the MAC Foundation has been added as an additional training site for them to serve both private and public sector entities and meet their training demands.
Now, this is a very important training operation. This involves OSHA. Many people know what OSHA is. That's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It's a federal agency, but they rely on a lot of nonprofits, I understand, all across the country, and I guess this particular group helps them out a lot, in being able to get this particular important and specific training so that people who are working in as we say, in offices or factories, certainly, and other industry, be able to follow the proper training rules and stay safe, I understand.
Exactly. So we're going to focus on hazardous materials trainings for employees, as well as confined space, things along those lines. And they also have a special interest in supporting nursing homes by providing them the OSHA-regulated guidelines. So we'll see some day-long programs like that, as well as emergency planning and other preparedness type of seminars.
Now, we know that the MAC Foundation facility in Valparaiso is well set up to handle firefighter training, and we talked about that earlier. And in this particular case, when you're dealing with special hazardous materials handling and confinement issues and things like that that OSHA is responsible for, how does that fit in with what you have there in Valparaiso to be able to help out on the nursing home segment of OSHA?
Yeah, well, fortunately for us, you know, the fire department is typically, along with our law enforcement partners, are typically the ones to be on scene first, right? Arrive on scene. And so for them to be able to see the training that employers and employees are being offered and also be training on the same field is a real unique opportunity for increased collaboration and, moreover, more opportunities to work together.
And I guess these are all come together in the one-day seminars that you set up in cooperation with other organizations, right?
That's correct. And so we offer a number of trainings now. A number of various nonprofits use the MAC facility for their specific trainings. But now we'll be able to, in addition to support our first responder community, we'll be able to reach a new constituency, essentially.
Mm-hmm. I guess they're very long involved training processes that can be offered by OSHA, with week-long courses, but not everybody can be able to make it off work or get their assignment changed to be able to attend these things.
Exactly. And for the MAC, you know, we also have, we're open essentially from 7 to 10 at night.
Mm-hmm.
We have classes going on afternoons, evenings, as well as weekends. So the flexibility that our site offers was incredibly attractive to OSHA as well.
It's interesting that you have these opportunities to be able to allow these classes to be held not quite around the clock, but almost around the clock. That probably is very convenient to a lot of businesses and industries. And in particular, in this case, when we have issues involving OSHA that are concerned, it's important to get these people in to get the training that they need.
Yes, and for first responders, I mean, the flexibility, given the fact that 70% of, especially all fire departments, are volunteers, you know, many of these men and women are working full-time, have other life commitments that they attend to during the day, and so offering evening and weekend classes is something that suits them even better.
Now, we know that the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative Foundation there in Valparaiso is a very busy place with all of the training courses that are underway right now. Celine, is there anything else that the MAC Foundation is working on to bring to the future in addition to this new addition involving these OSHA courses?
In addition to this announcement, this partnership with OSHA, we are proactively working at launching our fire and rescue program for high school students at the MAC.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we're always growing, always looking for innovative ways to grow and ultimately to increase our presence in the community, but more importantly, to have a positive impact in public safety throughout Northwest Indiana.
Well, Celina, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this, and congratulations for picking up this very important business and industrial training segment here involving OSHA to be taken care of there at the MAC Foundation facility, Montale Park Drive in Valparaiso. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Celina Werthewax is with the MAC Foundation based in Valparaiso.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Human trafficking is a serious problem here in Northwest Indiana. It's not always talked about, although we have had some conversations on the side about it from law enforcement agencies and about the way that they are trying to deal with the problem. But let's find out more from the standpoint of a couple psychologists and some other people who are involved in an organization which is called the Safe Coalition for Human Rights. Let's take on now this topic and talking with Dr. Kalyani Gopal, who is a Munster-based psychologist, her colleague, Dr. Sandra Demos Kelly, and Steve Armenta, who is a board member for the Safe Coalition for Human Rights, with us now on the phone here from the office. Thank you very much, all, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Well, let's first, Dr. Gopal, let's talk about the major problem. How does it face Northwest Indiana residents? We know the police are busy dealing with problems in motels and hotels all across the region, in particular on 8094 and along I-65, but there are problems that in turn would get citizens involved at one point in time. But give us first an idea of just the overall problem of human trafficking here in the region.
So our region is actually the intersection between Chicago and the rest of the Midwest. Chicago O'Hare Airport is the largest airport for the Midwest and the largest incoming for immigrants and others into the Midwest region. We not only have close proximity to the O'Hare Airport, but we also are the third largest seaport. And so we have the waterways, we have the airways, and we have the freeways, three ways by which individuals are trafficked into our region. And we're right on the border between Illinois and Indiana. So Northwest Indiana is like a prime area for human trafficking. We actually get victims all the way from Wisconsin and Ohio because of the tri-state area. And this is a huge trucking area in this region. So since we have such so many truck stops and so many areas in which these children and adults can be trafficked, it's a very convenient stopping point for many traffickers.
When we talk about the trafficking problem, we're talking, of course, about the adults who happen to get hold of the young children and move them around from one location to the other, but also involves the folks who seek out these young children. And I guess some of these, I understand, are as young as 10 years of age?
Absolutely.
When you talk about a problem like this, you have a lot of various angles to look at here, and I know that you and your colleagues, and as being psychologists, take a look at this too. What other facets of the community are working with you all, with this organization, the Safe Coalition for Human Rights, in working with others to try to deal with the problem, first off, of the fact that the human trafficking exists, as well as how you could try to work with the law enforcement agencies to stop it?
You know, if I might just mention, I'm Steve Armenta. Just a concerned citizen and precinct committeeman from Hobart, Indiana. And I just would like to tell you that there are some people getting involved with State Chair that are going to, such people, owners of restaurants, people that are with the various groups that are going to be major contributors to this epidemic. It's something that is not just local. You know, I live in Knob Hill, of course, and I have a home in Portage, but outside of this area, these people are trafficking and bringing these people into, as she mentioned, Motel 6 and these other different places in our area. We're not going to stand for it. We're going to take a stand. And that's why I want to mention at this time that we are going to have on Friday, June 1st, 2018, at the Ambassador Banquet Hall, which, by the way, the Jared Demas family has been so gracious to donate not only their time and their money, but it's going to be a nice event that's going to take place at the banquet hall just directly behind the Paragon on Route 6 in Hobart. The time will be from 6 p.m. to midnight. We've contracted Dave Alamillo from Monterey and the last living survivor of the Spaniels to play, and it's going to be a worthwhile event. I think that as I tell more people in my community and the surrounding areas about this epidemic, more people want to be inclusive.
I understand, too, that we're going to see Judge Mary Beth Venaventura, who is, of course, a former Lake County juvenile court judge involved with young people, as well as the former executive director of the Indiana State Department of Child Services, having to be the featured speaker. She looks at the picture not only from a Northwest Indiana angle, but from a statewide angle, too, and I'm sure she'll have some very interesting things to talk about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In fact, she also is now special counsel for the attorney general. Mm-hmm. And one of the frustrations we've had over the years is that when we rescue these kids, many of them are from foster care. And it goes across the spectrum. We have kids who are straight-A students from schools like Griffith and Munster and other schools. It doesn't matter what socioeconomic status they come from. These are regular kids. And these aren't kids we're talking about on the streets. These are kids who come from parents' homes where, you know, their parents are middle-class families just like ours, But these kids are bored, or they're enticed into this by the traffickers, because there's an innocence in the Hoosier kids that's not there among the Chicago kids. The Chicago is a little bit more streetwise than our kids are. And our kids are very easily gullible. And unfortunately, because of the internet and the easy access to social media, many of our kids are very innocently groomed into the human trafficking world.
Would you also say, too, that many of these young children that are involved, unfortunately, being brought into the human trafficking problem are not only young people, but they're of all races and creeds?
Absolutely. I've seen all races, all creeds, and boys as well. Mm-hmm. We've had boys recruiting girls. We have girls recruiting boys in high schools. So no one is immune to this problem. It cuts across all levels of society.
We're talking with Dr. Kalyani Gopal, as well as Steve Armenta, who's a concerned citizen, lives in Hobart, and is a member of the Safe Coalition for Human Rights. Dr. Sandra Demas-Kelly, I understand, is with us, too, on our call today. And since you and Dr. Gopal are psychologists, what do you happen to see in your practice and dealing with the problem?
Well, I'm a therapist, and I primarily work with school-aged children, and there is a true vulnerability amongst our children. They don't feel safe. They don't feel safe in schools. They don't feel safe walking home from schools. There's a trust issue. They don't know who to talk to. Many of them are afraid of sharing feelings. So they'll come in and they'll just feel almost trapped, that they really can't talk about what's going on in the schools. They're afraid to open up because they're afraid of repercussions, basically, if they talk. So mm-hmm. another thrust, especially in the schools, is having children openly talk about their issues so that we can address them and we can address them quickly. And let's not wait until they're 18. Let's not wait until they're 16. Let's move quickly into schools when they are pre-adolescents and let them know what a healthy relationship actually looks like.
Now, you folks involved in Safe Coalition for Human Rights, you mentioned you have a fundraiser coming up on June 1st. It'll be at the Ambassador Banquet Hall in Hobart. And with that, of course, is going to have an opportunity to hear Judge Mary Beth Fontura speak as the featured speaker for the night. But I understand, too, Dr. Gopal, that you and the members of the Safe Foundation are on a mission, and it's a very ambitious mission to try to help these young people in a very special sort of way. Will you tell us about that?
Absolutely, and I'll have Commander Ed Peralta, who's a veteran and who's in charge of all the security of this group, for this mm-hmm. Holistic center we're developing. His group, his team, the United States Security, is going to be in charge of the entire security for the village. We're building a holistic, self-sustaining, restorative center in which we're going to house about 100 children and about 20 adults. The reason we're doing that is because we really don't have a place. Once they're rescued, there's nowhere to put these children and these adults. So what happens is they end up going back to the trafficker. The problem is we are picking up these kids, we are rescuing them, we're spending billions of dollars on just rescuing these individuals. But once they're rescued, we put them in a holding pen, which is really not a place for traumatized people to be. Mm-hmm. And I'll let Commander Peralta speak.
Yes, please, if you will, Ed, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ed Peralta. I'm with the United States Security. And I just wanted to inform you that the veterans that we have, male and female veterans, that have a big heart, that fought for our nation, and are worried about our children. We want to make sure that people realize we're not building a prison and we're not building a jail. We're building and constructing a safe haven, for a safe village for the children. The outside of the perimeter will be similar to a gated community, and the children and the vets that live on the property will have free access to move around at ease. Of course, we'll have biometrics there to make sure the outside perimeter is a foolproof from the pimps and the drug czars that try to impede and pull these kids out of the safe village. That's our problem, and it's a big problem. And it's not only men that are abusing our children, it's women too.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that's what I wanted to inform you. We have numerous religions. Also, we show the kids that there's a light at the end of the tunnel by going through our program. And when they reach age 17, there are companies out there, corporations out there, that want to hire these children because they have been trained and reprogrammed to society, and they would be a credit to the corporation that is hiring them because of the proven work that Dr. Coppell and Dr. Demo Cicchelli has produced the product out there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about this facility. I take it that this is going to be the opportunity that law enforcement agencies probably have been looking forward to, is to have some place that if youngsters happen to be picked up in raids or whatever the case may be, or through other investigations involved in human trafficking, that the youngsters can be taken to, as you say, a safe place, and a place where they can feel safe themselves, but also become rehabilitated and get back into the normal life?
Absolutely. And so the school system will not be burdened because we'll have a school within the facility itself
mm-hmm.
that they can then transition to regular school. So it won't be a burden on the school system with having these kids here. Rather, it'll be an easier transition once we work with these children and they're able to then come up to the education level for the regular school system, and then we'll transition them back to the school system. So it'll be relieving the schools of many children which otherwise would have fallen through the cracks and basically would have dropped out of school or turned to, the opioids, which is already a crisis in this state.
Have you had a chance to talk with some of the officials, not only the state but the federal officials as well as the other school corporation officials in the area about this idea?
I would like to just mention there are, and just the meeting that we had earlier today at 10 o'clock, we have federal people involved. We have local authorities involved. I want to commend Oscar Martinez, who is in full compliance, sending his people to our meetings. And we were privileged to let you know that the immediate number locally that you need for anybody that needs tickets or wants to find out more about this subject would be my direct number, 219-613-3093. Or for other tickets and for tables that are going to be presented for different people would be 312-998-2339. And again, my name's Steve Armenta. That phone number is 219-613-3093. And I do have someone here from Indianapolis that I had the pleasure of meeting today, sir, that I just have to introduce you to.
Okay, briefly, Vicky. Please.
Vicky from Indianapolis.
Well, Vicky,
pleasure to meet you, sir.
My role here
for Safe Chair is I'm going to be leading a cooking school in order to not only teach our survivors of human trafficking, but not only that, but give them a career for a future and mentor them so they can have the opportunity to grow and to have a passion and be able to grow in their field.
Well, Vicky, welcome from Indianapolis. Welcome to here in Northwest Indiana. And we're going to have to leave it at that, but we'll come back to the topic again soon. In fact, we should once again remind you that Safe Condition for Human Rights is going to hold a special meeting and fundraiser on June 1st. It's at the Ambassador Banquet Hall on East 37th Avenue in Hobart. And you can get more information if you go on the Eventbrite website. You can find more information from there as well, too. Thank you all for being with us. We were going to have to revisit this topic again soon.
Thank
and certainly hereafter you have your event on June 1st, we'll get back together again and talk more about this and see how close we are to reaching the goals that you're hoping to reach within the entire coalition. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses by sponsoring Regionally Speaking. Learn more about all the benefits. Call us at 219-756-5656.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Sound Bites is now sponsored by JP Morgan Chase. Do you ever wish you could go back in time? You're not alone. While time travel is not yet a viable option, one Indiana professor is living out his dreams of going back in time. Back to ancient Rome, to be exact. A lot of us love imagining life in the past, but Dr. Bernard Fisher doesn't have to imagine it. He can observe it himself. No, it's not time travel exactly, but it's as close as technology can get us. It's called archaeoinformatics. Dr. Fisher, better known as Bernie, is the director of Virtual World Heritage Lab at Indiana University, which is just one of the many innovative projects in the informatics school on Indiana University's Bloomington campus. IU's informatics program is a nationally ranked program for people who utilize cutting-edge technologies to solve real-world problems. There are many different kinds of informatics based on the kinds of problems somebody is using technology to solve. Bioinformatics uses technology to solve problems in the field of biology. And Internet security informatics uses cutting-edge technology to solve digital security problems. Bernie's field is archaeoinformatics. He uses the latest technologies on the market to solve exciting problems in archaeology. Archaeoinformatics allows Bernie to infer how things may have looked in the past by creating 3D models of those places or those pieces of art and sharing them for free on the internet. Bringing that kind of information to the average person allows us all to see what homes looked like and where people gathered in ancient Rome. Observing these spaces gives us huge clues as to how people lived and what they valued at that time. These things are the closest we have to observing ancient Rome ourselves. For his personal business, Rome Reborn, Bernie and his team created 3D models to discover the purpose of two monuments in Rome that were placed there in the first century. In order to do this, Bernie used computational equations to figure out the monument's initial placement. Then by imitating the rise and fall of the sun, Bernie and his team were able to simulate the movement of the sun, which shed light on the meaning of these sculptures to the Romans.
Suddenly the whole thing made sense, and there, you know, shivers went up and down everybody's spine. And nobody ever suspected it, because nobody ever was able to do that time travel and go back to Rome, move the dials on the sun and the sky, and, you know, just stand in the virtual landscape and make observations.
It was Bernie's innovative spirit and passion for digital archaeology that created the Virtual Heritage Lab and inspired the department at IU. Now, the IU Informatics Department enables Bernie to continue to work on new projects, like the digitization of the entire collection of the Uffizi Museum in Italy that has more than 1,250 ancient statues. By digitizing the collection, Bernie and IU hope to give as many people access to the 3D images as possible, no matter where they are in the world. Bernie thinks of each piece of art, monument, and city as clues about the past. The more people who have access to each clue, the more well-developed the theories of historians, archaeologists, and scientists will be. Throughout his life, Bernie always attempted to combine his love for the arts and his fascination with technology. As a young man, he experimented with electronic music, filmmaking, philosophy, and many other things before combining archaeology and technology to create the Virtual Heritage Lab. For example, in the 1980s, he was one of the first people to run out and buy a personal computer, and one of the first people to have access to the internet, which at the time you had to sign up for through the Pentagon.
And my colleagues thought that this was some kind of a phase I was going through, and a passing hobby that I would outgrow, and I'd get back to doing the research and thinking that they hired me to do in the mid-70s. But instead, it only got worse.
Luckily for us, his willingness to combine the STEM and humanities has pushed the fields of archaeology, technology, and history to new heights. And most importantly, have allowed the students of Indiana and beyond the unique opportunity to work under the leading innovator in this field. The Virtual Heritage Lab is just one fascinating example of the innovative work being done on informatics at Indiana University. Check out their website for more information. and tune in next week for a different story of Hoosier innovation. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton.
A school safety measure is among those that lawmakers are considering today when they meet for their special legislative session. And Indiana Public Broadcasting, Jeannie Lindsay, has a preview for us.
The regular session's school safety bill focused on human trafficking and cyberbullying at first. But after the Parkland, Florida shooting, lawmakers added more school safety language into the bill that ultimately didn't pass. Now it's back, and part of it would allow teachers to wait for up to 3 minutes before evacuating students during an unplanned fire alarm, just in case of a school shooter. But State Department of Education spokesperson Adam Baker says it's just an option for schools.
But one of the things that we've also stressed to them is make sure at all times all of your community partners are involved.
The bill also creates a loan program to help schools pay for safety upgrades and adds $5 million to the state's secured school fund. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
And now with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Eric Brandt, Director of Marketing at Chicago Street Theater. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, John. Great to be here again.
How many are you a paid employee as the
director? I am, yeah. We're a not-for-profit, volunteer-driven theater. Mm-hmm. So our board is volunteer. Our artists are all volunteer. But we have three lonely staff people, mm-hmm. which are myself, Sherry Nash Brown, who is our box office manager, and then Lisa Formosa Parmigiano, who is our education director. So right. Yeah, we operate on a very, very small scale,
yeah.
Although we do big things. So,
but I think it's really remarkable that there's a community theater group that where the board supports hiring staff
mm-hmm.
to professionalize the operation.
It does, and I think it also it creates a stability because you have the go-to employees who kind of keep things consistent across
sure.
the boards, because board members and membership and artists and directors and all those kind of things can change,
mm-hmm.
you know, from show to show even.
Right.
But we're kind of the constant
yeah.
in the organization. So.
And you came from the board though, right?
I was a member of the theater probably – I'm getting ready to log in here. I think this next season will be my 40th year
wow.
with them. I started with them when I was 17 and
oh,
in
fantastic.
High school. We were still at the Opera House, uh-huh. and I've acted, I've directed, I've designed sets, I've made costumes, although I don't boast too much about that because, you know, they'd want me for every show. I've done a little bit of everything. And part of how I kind of came into this position was our previous marketing director had left to do something else, mm-hmm. and I was between jobs, and a lot of what the marketing director did as far as community relationships and knowing people and working, getting advertising for the playbills and things like that, I had done as a volunteer before we had paid employees.
Right.
So it was just kind of a natural fit.
Yeah. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
Where people are it depends on how active they become as board members. And, mm-hmm. and in the case of your organization, it sounds like a lot of your board members.
It's a working board, yeah. I mean, there's different kind of boards you can have. You know, some organizations have money boards and some have working boards. Ours
right.
is very much a working board
yeah.
where each of the board members takes charge of a certain committee or ad hoc right. group and then kind of sees that up with the help of the staff members.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So you have quite a bit. You always have a lot of activities.
We
going
do.
On.
We do about 8 to 9 shows every season.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we keep it pretty busy. And then we also have our education program, the Children's Theater Works, they have a fall semester
mm-hmm.
That coincides with the Valpo school system. They have a spring semester that coincides with that. They do winter workshops in the area in between the
mm-hmm.
two fall and spring semesters. And then we have a huge summer program that runs June 11th through July 22nd this year. So
the next show is Fool for Love.
Fool for Love, yes.
And
that is opening on May 25th, and it's going to run through June 9th.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the early plays by Sam Shepard, who mm-hmm. is a Pulitzer Prize winner playwright. He passed away just last year from Lou Gehrig's disease, and we had selected this show because our theater is always likes the gritty, the kind of challenging,
the risk. Steppenwolf of Northwest Indiana.
We've kind of gotten that reputation. I mean, we get made fun of that we say edgy all the time, part of what we try to do. We try to offer an eclectic experience for our audiences and our season subscribers. But the thing that we've kind of become known for is doing those kind of challenging works that you would expect to go see in a black box in Chicago. Sure. And so I guess kind of keeping that urban feel of our theater. It's very intimate. It only seats 129 people. When you have a theater like that, you can educate your audiences about these – more about the playwrights and things like that, but still be bringing people in to see family shows. And then maybe if they take advantage of seeing something like Sideways Stories that we did earlier that, you know, blew the charts out. I think it, you know, we had full houses every show, but then maybe mom and dad will come back and see something more risky and challenging and dramatic. And so Sam Shepard's always been a favorite of ours. And I think this is one of a particular cycle that consists of Fool for Love, True West, Buried Child, Curse of the Starving Class, and Lie of the Mind. This was the one that we hadn't done yet from that whole cycle of plays that he had written. Good. So,
well, we have to ring off as it happens, but so we don't have time to talk about summer. But there's summer theater camps,
summer theater camps,
and Much Ado is your
Shakespeare in the Park is Much Ado About Nothing, and it's going to be a huge.
Well, you can come back. And
talk
with us again.
I'll come back.
All right,
absolutely,
thanks, Eric. Thanks
thank
for
you
being
so
here.
Much,
and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can of course always catch Eye on the Arts here on Lakeshore Public Radio, and regionally speaking, or you can catch the full conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.